Chapter 2, Crossing the Threshold, 1967 to 1979. I came into this period with the biases I had picked up from my experiences and the people around me. In 1966, asset prices reflected investors' optimism about the future. But between 1967 and 1979, bad economic surprises led to big and unexpected price declines. Not just the economy and the markets, but social sentiment deteriorated as well. Living through that taught me that while almost everyone expects the future to be a slightly modified version of the present, it is almost always very different. But I didn't know that in 1967. Certain that stocks would eventually rebound, I kept buying them, even as the market fell, and I lost money until I figured out what was going wrong and how to deal with it. I gradually learned that prices tend to reflect people's expectations, so they go up when actual results are better than expected, and they go down when they are worse than expected, and most people tend to be biased by their recent experiences. That fall, I started at a local college, CW Post. I got in on probation because of my C average in high school. But unlike high school, I loved college because I could learn about things that interested me, not because I had to, so I got great grades. I also loved living away from home and having the independence. Learning to meditate helped me too. When the Beatles visited India in 1968 to study transcendental meditation at the ashram of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, I was curious to learn it, so I did. I loved it. Meditation has benefited me hugely throughout my life because it produces a calm, open-mindedness that allows me to think more clearly and more creatively. I majored in finance in college because of my love for the markets and because that major had no foreign language requirement. So it allowed me to learn what I was interested in, both inside and outside class. I learned a lot about commodity futures from a very interesting classmate, a Vietnam veteran quite a bit older than me. Commodities were attractive because they could be traded with very low margin requirements, meaning I could leverage the limited amount of money I had to invest. If I could make big winning decisions, which I planned to do, I could borrow more money to make more money. Stock, bond, and currency futures didn't exist back then. Commodity futures were strictly real commodities like corn, soybeans, cattle, and hogs. So those were the markets I started to trade and learn about. My college years coincided with the era of free love, mind-expanding drug experimentation, and rejection of traditional authority. Living through it had a lasting effect on me and many others of my generation. For example, it impacted Steve Jobs, who I came to empathize with and admire. Like me, he took up meditation and wasn't interested in being taught as much as he loved visualizing and building out amazing new things. The times we lived in taught us both to question established ways of doing things, an attitude he demonstrated superbly in Apple's 1984 and Here's to the Crazy Ones, which were ad campaigns that spoke to me. For the country as a whole, those were difficult years. As the draft expanded and the number of young Americans coming home in body bags soared, the Vietnam War split the country. There was a lottery based on birthdays to determine the order of those who would be drafted. I remember listening to the lottery on the radio while playing pool with my friends. It was estimated that the first 160 or so birthdays called would be drafted, though they read off all 366 dates. My birthday was the 48th called. I wasn't smart enough to be afraid of going to war because I naively thought nothing bad could happen to me. But I didn't want to go because I was charging forward with my life, and to put it on hold for 2 years seemed like an eternity. My dad, though, was adamantly against the war and hell-bent against me going, even though he had believed in and fought in the two prior wars. He had me examined by a doctor who discovered I had hypoglycemia, which gave me an exemption. When I look back on that, I see that I got out of serving on a technicality, that my dad was essentially helping me dodge the draft, which now gives me mixed feelings. I feel guilty I didn't do my part, relieved I didn't experience the harmful consequences so many others suffered in the war, and appreciative of my dad for the love behind his effort to protect me. I have no idea what I would do if I was faced with the same situation today. As America's politics and economy deteriorated, the country's mood became more depressed. The Tet Offensive in January 1968 seemed to convey the U.S. was losing the war. That same year, Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for a second term, and Richard Nixon was elected, beginning an even more difficult era. At the same time, France's president, Charles de Gaulle, was turning in his country's dollars for gold because he was concerned that the U.S. was printing money to finance its spending. Watching the news and the markets move together, I began to see the whole picture and understand the cause-effect relationship between the two. Around 1970 or 71, I noticed gold was starting to pick up in world markets. Until then, like most people, I hadn't paid much attention to currency rates because the currency system had been stable throughout my lifetime. But as currency events increasingly appeared in the news, they caught my attention. I learned that other currencies were fixed against the dollar, and the dollar was fixed against gold, that Americans weren't allowed to own gold, though I wasn't sure why, and that other central banks could convert their paper dollars into gold, which is how they were assured that they wouldn't be hurt if the U.S. printed too many dollars. I heard our government officials poo-poo the worries about the dollar and the excitement about gold, assuring us that the dollar was sound and that gold was just an archaic metal. Speculators were behind the rising prices, they said, and they would get burned once things settled down. Back then, I still assumed that government officials were honest. In the spring of 1971, I graduated college with a nearly perfect grade point average, which got me into Harvard Business School. The summer before I started HBS, I got a job as a clerk on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. By midsummer, the dollar problem began to reach a breaking point. There were reports that Europeans wouldn't accept dollars from American tourists. The global monetary system was in the process of breaking down, but that wasn't clear to me yet. Then, on Sunday, August 15, 1971, President Nixon went on television to announce that the United States would renege on its promise to allow dollars to be turned in for gold, which led the U.S. dollar to plummet. Since government officials had promised not to devalue the dollar, I listened with amazement as he spoke. Instead of addressing the fundamental problems behind the pressure of the dollar, he continued to blame speculators, crafting his words to make it sound like he was just moving to support the dollar, while his actions were doing just the opposite. Floating it, as Nixon was doing, and then letting it sink like a stone, looked a lot like a lie to me. Over the decades since, I've repeatedly seen policymakers deliver such assurances immediately before currency devaluations, So I learned not to believe government policymakers when they assure you that they won't let the currency devaluation happen. The more strongly they make those assurances, the more desperate the situation probably is, so the more likely it is that a devaluation will take place. As I listened to Nixon speak, I wondered what those developments really meant. Money, as we'd known it, a claim check to get gold, no longer existed. That couldn't be good. It seemed clear to me that the era of promise that Kennedy had personified was unraveling. Monday morning, I walked onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange expecting pandemonium. There was pandemonium, all right, but not the sort I expected. Instead of falling, the stock market jumped about 4%, a huge gain. To try to understand what was happening, I spent the rest of the summer studying past currency devaluations. I learned that everything that was going on, the currency markets breaking the link to gold and devaluing, the stock market soaring in response, everything had happened before, and that logical cause-effect relationships made those developments inevitable. My failure to anticipate this, I realized, was due to my being surprised by something that hadn't happened in my lifetime, though it happened many times before. The message that reality was conveying to me was, you better make sense of what happened to other people in other times and other places, because if you don't, you won't know if these things are going to happen to you, and if they do, you won't know how to deal with them. Enrolling at Harvard Business School that fall, I was excited about meeting the extraordinarily intelligent people from all over the planet who would be my classmates. And high as my expectations were, the experience was even better. I lived with people from all over the world, and we partied together in an exciting, eclectic environment. There was no teacher in front of a blackboard telling us what to remember, and no tests to see what we remembered. Instead, we were given actual case studies to read and analyze. Then we gathered in groups to thrash out what we would do if we were in the shoes of the people in the situations. This was my kind of school. Meanwhile, thanks to the wave of money printing that had followed the demise of the gold standard, the economy and the stock market were soaring. Stocks were in again in 1972, and the fashion at the time was the Nifty 50. This group of stocks had fast and steady earnings growth and were widely believed to be a sure thing. As hot as the stock market was, I was more interested in trading commodities, so that spring I begged the director of commodities at Merrill Lynch to give me a summer job. He was surprised because people from places like Harvard Business School weren't typically interested in commodities, which were considered an obscure stepchild of the Wall Street brokerage industry. Up until then, as far as I know, no Harvard Business School student had ever worked in the commodity futures area. Most Wall Street firms didn't even have commodity futures divisions, and Merrill Lynch's was small, tucked away on a side street, and furnished with basic metal desks. A few months later, when I was back for my second year at HBS, the first oil shock began, with prices quadrupling in a matter of months. The U.S. economy slowed, commodity prices soared, and in 1973, the stock market took a dive. Once again, I was blindsided. But in retrospect, I could see that the dominoes had fallen in a logical sequence. In this case, the debt-financed overspending of the 1960s had continued into the early 1970s. The Fed had funded this spending with easy credit policies, but by paying back its debts with depreciated paper money instead of gold-backed dollars, the U.S. effectively defaulted. Naturally, with all this money printing, the dollar plunged in value. That allowed for more easy credit, which led to even more spending. The inflationary surge that followed the breakdown of the currency system sent commodity prices even higher. In response, in 1973, the Fed tightened monetary policy, which is what central bankers do when inflation and growth are too strong. This, in turn, caused the worst decline in stocks and the worst weakening of the economy since the Great Depression. The Nifty 50 were particularly affected, plunging severely. The lesson? When everybody thinks the same thing, such as what a sure bet the Nifty 50 is, it's almost certainly reflected in the price, and betting on it is probably going to be a mistake. I also learned that for every action, such as easy money and credit, there is a consequence, in this case higher inflation, roughly proportionate to that action, which causes an approximately equal and opposite reaction, such as the tightening of money and credit, and it causes market reversals. I was beginning to see things happening over and over again, which led me to see that most everything is another one of those. Most everything has happened repeatedly before for logical cause-effect reasons. Of course, being able to both properly identify which one of those are happening and to understand the cause-effect relationships behind them remain difficult. Though most everything seemed inevitable and logical in retrospect, nothing was nearly as clear in real time. Because people chase what's hot and avoid what's not, stock investing fell out of favor in 1973 and commodity trading became the thing to do. With my background in commodities and a Harvard MBA, I became a sought-after property. Dominic and Dominic, a middle-sized 100-year-old brokerage firm, hired me as director of commodities for $25,000 a year, which was near the top of what HBS graduates' starting salaries were at the time. My new boss paired me with an older, experienced guy who had lots of commodities brokerage experience, and we were assigned the task of setting up a commodities division. I was way over my head, though I was too arrogant to realize it at the time. I probably would have learned a lot of painful lessons had the job continued, but the bad stock market took Dominic and Dominic under before we made much progress. As the economy unraveled, the Watergate scandal dominated the headlines, and I saw how politics and economics intertwine, usually with economics leading. This downward spiral led people to become pessimistic, so they sold their stocks and the market continued to fall. Things couldn't have gotten much worse, but everyone was afraid that they would. It was the mirror image of what I'd witnessed in 1966 when the market hit its top. And just as it was then, the consensus was wrong. When people are very pessimistic, they sell out. Prices typically get very cheap, and the actions to improve conditions have to be taken. Sure enough, the Fed eased its monetary policies and stocks hit bottom in December 1974. At the time I was single and living in New York, I was having a great time partying with friends from HBS and dating a lot. My roommate was dating a Cuban woman, and he set me up on a blind date with one of her friends, an exotic woman from Spain named Barbara, who could barely speak English. This wasn't a problem because we communicated in different ways. She thrilled me for nearly 2 years before we moved in together, got married and had 4 sons, and shared an amazing life together. She still thrills me, but is too private a person for me to say much more about her. While I worked in the brokerage industry, I also traded my own account. Though I had many more winning positions than losing ones, I can only recall the losing ones now. I remember one big one, when I owned pork bellies. For several days, the market for them was limit down, meaning that the price had fallen so low that trading had to be stopped. I later described the impact of this experience to Jack Schwager, the author of Hedge Fund Market Wizards. In those days, we had the big commodity boards, which clicked whenever prices changed. Each morning, on the opening, I would see and hear the market click down 200 points, the daily limit, stay unchanged at that price, and know that I had lost that much more, with the amount of potential additional losses still undefined. It was a very tactile experience, and it taught me the importance of risk controls, because I never wanted to experience that pain again. It enhanced my fear of being wrong and taught me to make sure that no single bet, or even multiple bets, could cause me to lose more than an acceptable amount. In trading, you have to be defensive and aggressive at the same time. If you are not aggressive, you're not going to make money. And if you're not defensive, you're not going to keep the money you made. I believe that anyone who has made money in trading has to experience horrendous pain at some point. Trading is like working with electricity. You can get an electric shock. With that pork belly trade and other trades, I felt the electric shock and the fear that comes with it. After Dominic and Dominic closed its retail business, I moved to a bigger, more successful brokerage firm. During my short stay there, it took over numerous other firms and changed its name several times, eventually becoming Shearson, though Sandy Weill stayed in charge through it all until 1985. Shearson put me in charge of its futures hedging business, which included both commodity futures and financial futures. I was the person helping clients who had price risks in their business manage them by using futures. I developed quite an expertise in the grain and livestock markets, which led me down to West Texas and the agricultural areas of California. The Shearson brokers, cattle producers, and grain dealers I dealt with were great folks who brought me into their worlds, taking me to honky-tonks, dove hunts, and barbecues. We worked and we had a blast together. I built a second life with them that lasted several years, though my job at Shearson only lasted a bit more than a year. Much as I loved the job and the people that I worked with, I didn't fit into the Shearson organization. Frankly, I was too wild. For example, as a joke that now seems pretty stupid, I hired a stripper to drop her cloak while I was lecturing at a whiteboard at the California Grain and Feed Association's annual convention. I also punched my boss in the face. Not surprisingly, I was fired. But the brokers, their clients, and even the ones who fired me liked me and wanted to keep getting my advice. Even better, they were willing to pay for it. So in 1975, I started Bridgewater Associates. Starting Bridgewater. I actually restarted it. Just after I graduated from HBS and went to work in commodities at Dominic and Dominic, I'd set up a little business with Bob Scott, a friend of mine from HBS. Along with a few pals in other countries, we made half-hearted attempts to sell commodities from the U.S. to other countries. We called it Bridgewater because we were bridging the waters and it had a good ring to it. By 1975, there wasn't much left of this commodities company, but it did already exist on paper, so I used it. I worked out of my two-bedroom apartment. When a pal from HBS who I shared the apartment with moved out, I made his bedroom an office. I worked with another friend I played rugby with, and we hired a great young woman who worked as our assistant. That was Bridgewater. I spent most of my time following the markets and putting myself in the shoes of my corporate clients to show them how I would handle market risks if I were them. And of course, I continued to trade my own account. Pursuing a mission with friends to help clients beat the markets was much more fun than having a real job. As long as my basic living expenses were covered, I knew I'd be happy. In 1977, Barbara and I decided to have a child, so we got married. We moved into a rented brownstone in Manhattan, and I moved the company there too. The Russians were buying a lot of grain at the time and wanted my advice, so I took her on a combined honeymoon business trip to the USSR. We arrived in Moscow on New Year's Eve and rode by bus from the drab airport through a dusting of snow past St. Basil's Cathedral to a big party with a lot of incredibly friendly, fun-loving Russians. My business has always been a way for me to get into exotic places and allow me to meet interesting people. If I make any money on those trips, that's just the icing on the cake. Modeling markets as machines. I was really getting my head into the livestock, meat, grain, and oilseed markets. I love them because they were concrete and less subject than stocks to distorted perceptions of value. While stocks can stay too high or too low because greater fools kept buying or selling them, livestock ended up in the meat counter, where it could be priced based on what consumers were willing to pay. I could visualize the processes that led to those sales and see the relationships underlying them. Since livestock eat grain, mostly corn and soy meal, and since corn and soybeans compete for acreage, those markets are closely related. I learned just about everything imaginable about them, what the planted acreage and typical yields were in each of those major growing areas, how to convert rainfall levels in different weeks of the growing season into yield estimates, how to project harvest sizes, carrying costs, and livestock inventories by weight group, location, and the rates of weight gain, and how to project dressing yields, retailer margins, consumer preferences by cut of meat, and the amounts to be slaughtered each season. This wasn't academic learning. People with practice in the business showed me how the agricultural processes worked, and I organized what they told me into models I used to map the interactions of those parts through time. For example, by knowing how many cattle, chickens, and hogs were being fed, how much grain they ate, and how fast they gained weight, I could project both when and how much meat would come to the market, and when and how much corn and soy meal would be consumed. Likewise, by seeing how much acreage was planted with corn and soybeans in all of the growing areas, doing regressions that showed how rainfall affected the yields in each of these areas, and applying weather forecasts and rainfall data, I could project the timing and the quantity of corn and soybean production. To me, it all looked like a beautiful machine with logical cause-effect relationships. By understanding these relationships, I could come up with decision rules or principles that I could model. These early models were a far cry from the ones we use now. They were based on back-of-the-envelope sketches, analyzed and converted into computer programs with the technology I could afford at the time. At the very beginning, I did regressions on my handheld Hewlett-Packard HP67 calculator, plotted charts by hand with colored pencils, and recorded every trade in composition notebooks. When the personal computer came along, I could input the numbers and watch them be converted into pictures of what would happen on spreadsheets. Knowing how cattle, hogs, and chickens progressed through their stages of production, how they competed for meat-eater dollars, what meat-eaters would spend and why, and how the profit margins of meat packers and retailers would influence their behaviors. For example, which cuts of meat they would push in advertisements and which they wouldn't. I could see how the machine produced cattle and hog and chicken prices that I could bet on. As basic as those early models were, I loved building and refining them, and they were good enough to make money. The approach to price determination I was using was different from the ones I had learned in my economics classes, where supply and demand were both measured in terms of the quantity sold. I found it much more practical to measure demand in the amount spent instead of the quantity bought, and to look at who the buyers and sellers were and why they bought and sold. I will explain this approach in Economic and Investment Principles. This different approach was one of the key reasons I caught economic and market moves that others missed. From that point on, whenever I looked at any market, commodities, stocks, bonds, currencies, or whatever, I could see and understand imbalances. Others who define supply and demand in the traditional way, in other words, in units, had missed. Visualizing complex systems as machines, figuring out the cause-effect relationships within them, writing down principles for dealing with them, and feeding them into a computer so that the computer could make decisions for me became my standard practice. Don't get me wrong, my approach was far from perfect. I vividly remember one can't-lose bet that personally cost me about $100,000. That was most of my net worth at the time. More painfully still, it hurt my clients. The most painful lesson that was repeatedly hammered home is that you can never be sure of anything. There are always risks out there that can hurt you badly, even the seemingly safest bets. So it's always best to assume that you're missing something. This lesson changed my approach to decision-making in ways that will reverberate throughout this book, and to which I attribute much of my success. But I would make many, many other mistakes before I changed my behavior enough. Building the business. While making money was good, having meaningful work and meaningful relationships was much better. To me, meaningful work is being on a mission I become engrossed in. And meaningful relationships are those I have with people I care deeply about and who care deeply about me. Think about it. It's senseless to have making money as your goal, as money has no intrinsic value. Its value comes from what it can buy, and it can't buy everything. It's smarter to start with what you really want, which are your real goals, and then work back to what you need to attain them. Money will be one of those things you need, but it's not the only one, and it's certainly not the most important one once you get past having the amount you need to get what you really want. When thinking about what you really want, it pays to think about what their relative values are so you weigh them properly. In my case, I wanted meaningful work and meaningful relationships equally, and I valued money less, as long as I had enough money to take care of my basic needs. In thinking about the relative importance of great relationships and money, it was clear that relationships were more important because there is no amount of money I would take in exchange for a meaningful relationship, because there is nothing I could buy with that money that would be more valuable. So, for me, meaningful work and meaningful relationships were, and they still are, my primary goals, and everything I did was for them. Making money was an incidental consequence of that. In the late 1970s, I began sending my observations about the markets to clients via telex. The genesis of these daily observations, which were broken down into different parts, grain and oil seeds, livestock and meats, economy and financial markets, it was all pretty simple. While our primary business was in managing risk exposures, our clients also called to pick my brain about the markets. Taking those calls became time-consuming, so I decided it would be more efficient to write down my thoughts every day so others could understand my logic and help improve it. It was a good discipline since it forced me to research and reflect every day. It also became a key channel of communication for our business. Today, almost 40 years and 10,000 publications later, our daily observations are read, reflected on, and argued about by clients and policymakers around the world. I'm still writing them, along with others at Bridgewater, and I expect to continue to write them until people don't care to read them, or until I die. In addition to providing clients with these observations and advice, I began to manage their exposures by buying and selling on their behalf. Sometimes I was paid a fixed fee each month, and sometimes I received a percentage of the profits. Among my consulting clients during the period was McDonald's, which was a huge buyer of beef, and Lane Processing, then the largest chicken producer in the country. I made them both a lot of money, especially Lane Processing, which did even better from its speculation in the grain and soy markets than it did in raising and selling chickens. Around the time, McDonald's had conceived of a new product, the Chicken McNugget, but they were reluctant to bring it to market because of their concern that chicken prices might rise and squeeze their profit margins. Chicken producers like Lane wouldn't agree to sell to them at a fixed price because they were worried that their costs would go up and they would be squeezed. As I thought about the problem, it occurred to me that in economic terms, a chicken can be seen as a simple machine consisting of a chick plus its feed. The most volatile cost that the chicken producer needed to worry about was feed prices. I showed Lane how to use a mix of corn and soy meal futures to lock in its cost so that it could quote a fixed price to McDonald's. Having greatly reduced its price risk, McDonald's introduced the McNugget in 1983. I felt great about helping to make that happen. I identified similar types of price relationships in the cattle and meat markets. For example, I showed cattle feeders how they could lock in strong profit margins by hedging good price relationships between their cost items, in other words, their feeder cattle, corn, and soy meal, and what they were going to sell, which is fed cattle, 6 months later. I developed a way of selling different cuts of fresh meat for future delivery at fixed prices far below frozen meat prices, but that still produced a big profit margin. Combining my clients' deep understanding of the way the machines of their own businesses operated with my knowledge of the way the markets functioned worked to our mutual advantage while making the markets more efficient overall. My ability to visualize these complex machines gave us a competitive edge against those who were shooting from the hip and eventually changed the way these industries operated. And as always, it was a kick to be working with the people I liked. On March 26, 1979, my wife gave birth to our first son, Devin. To have a child was the most difficult decision I ever made because I couldn't know what the experience would be like, and it would be irrevocable. It turned out to be my best decision. While I won't delve too much into my family life in these books, I pursued it with the same sort of intensity which I pursued my career, and I linked them. To give you an idea about how interwoven they were in my mind, Devon was named for one of the oldest breeds of cattle known to man, among the first breeds imported into the U.S. and renowned for its high fertility.